The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Good morning, and welcome to Campus Voices here at WVUD. I'm Richard Gordon, and Allie Delaney is here with me, and today we're sitting down with another member of the faculty of the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, Associate Professor Jennifer Biddle. Thanks for coming by.
All right, thanks for having me, Rich. Very pleased to be here.
My first question for you, Dr. Biddle, is what do you conduct your research on with marine science?
So I am a latecomer to marine science, even though they gave me the position in the School of Marine Science and Policy. We work on microbes. And so I look at microbes in the environment, where they're living, why they're living there. And it turns out we don't know a lot about microbes, especially in the marine environment. So there's a lot of actual discovery to do in many different shallow and deep marine environments.
So as a communication student, I have no idea what microbes are. Could you just enlighten us a little bit?
All right. So microbes, they're in you, they're on you, they are you. And microbes are basically individual tiny cells that live their life that way. And so they go through an asexual reproduction, and they are the simplest forms of life. And when we say simple, we mean in terms of size and complexity. In reality, they're actually really complex, and they are the organisms from which basically all life arose, and that they are the ancestors on our planet.
So they're a single cell, and the ones you look at are the ones that swim around in the ocean.
They are a single cell, but to actually be completely precise, not all of them swim. So some of them swim, and some of them just kind of are passive and get carried along.
So how do you go about researching microbes?
All right, so that's a great question, because I was actually just teaching a class on this. And in the old days, right, the first microbes that were ever discovered were actually discovered by looking through the microscope. So there's a lot of just visual work we can do with microscopy and different kinds of microscopy, where basically you're just amplifying a very small thing to visibly look bigger. And that's one of the ways to do it, but you don't get that much information. So the other way to do it is to grow them in the lab. And my lab tries to do this all the time. We take a sample and we try to coax a microbe to grow out of it into the lab. This was actually done in the initial days by actually using a clean slice of a potato. And imagine you have a clean slice of a potato, and then you take some dirt and you spread it over the potato, you'll actually get individual microbes growing on that clean potato slice. You probably do it in your leftover Chinese food or something that's in your fridge for a long time, and you'll actually see little spots of fuzzy things or maybe little dots growing. And so we know that some things can grow. But it turns out that a lot of things actually won't grow in a laboratory. So in the past 20 years, there's been this revolution in sequencing. And so we know that microbes have DNA and RNA, just like our cells, right? And the DNA can tell us who they are and what they do. And what we can do is we actually just grind up everything. So I spend a lot of my time nowadays killing microbes because we want to split them up and study their guts. And so I used to call it like a divination, right? That people actually used to do this in the old days. They take intestines and they try to foretell the future. Well, we can actually do that with microbes. We pull out their guts and we can send them through the sequencer. And so I spend a lot of time at the Delaware Biotechnology Institute on the other side of campus here. And we actually sequence them down to their ATCs and Gs, and then we take the computer and put them back together.
You're talking about single-cell organism. You're talking about pulling their guts out?
Yep.
Wait a minute. They're single-cell organisms.
Yeah, but it turns out that you can pop them really easily. What we do is we can actually just chemically lyse their membranes, or we can physically grind them up, and we can then pull that DNA out, clean it, because it's a chemical, basically. We would clean it off, and we're able to then feed that DNA into that sequencer. And we study them based on their sequences alone. So it would kind of be like saying I know everything about humanity because I've read the phone book, right? I know where your name is and where you live. But at that point, actually, I can probably get a lot of information out of that. And so we're able to then reconstruct the genes. We're able to reconstruct what enzymes they would have and then see what function they might be able to do in the environment.
You said, again, I'm just fascinated with the idea of a single cell organism that's got all these different functions it does, even though it's still one cell.
And so basically they do a lot of complex biology. So they can, in terms of us, like we are very sort of simple biochemical machines, right? We eat sugar, we output CO2, we input oxygen. And so in a basis, that's what happens. And so it turns out with microbes, they do very much the same thing. Some of them make their own food and can make their own bodies. They're called autotrophs. And some of them can also just eat sugar and live on what already exists, and they would be a heterotroph. And both of those flavors of things live in almost every single environment.
Do all microbes divide? Is that how they grow? Or do some of them reproduce in other ways?
So they all divide eventually, but that's actually a really good question, because there are actually some crazy microbes out there that have different kinds of lifestyles. And so I wish I could, it's a bad part about radio. I can't show you what they look like. But some of them actually are really cool. There's one called Colobacter, and it's known that it sits down on a surface. And so imagine sort of a lollipop stuck into a piece of foam. That's kind of what the cell would look like on a rock surface, let's say in a river. And it's happy, and it kind of just grows there, and it's stuck to that rock by its lollipop stick. It's called a stalk. And then when it decides to grow, it actually separates out, and the other side of it becomes a swimming cell. And so as it separates, that lollipop kind of develops a little snowman type of physique, and then the top of the snowman pops off and swims away to go find another rock to sit down on.
How do microbes operate, like, above the sea versus below the sea?
We have sort of three different environments to think about. Imagine you're in the middle of the ocean, and what you have is sky, right? And so we know that there are contributions to the oceans from the sky through rain. We know actually microbes live in clouds. So basically, microbes can survive in the atmosphere. They actually get sent around the world on little particles, like dust particles. We know that there is a ton of Saharan dust falling into the ocean, coming just through wind. And so there's sort of that environment. And microbes that are doing that, they need to survive the fact that they're drying out. They need to survive the fact that there's not that much water and there's a ton of UV light. So then they fall into the ocean, or they come from other ways. There's some things that just live in the ocean all the time. Well, they're in water all the time. But also it means is there's really nowhere to hide. So much like a shark could be able to chase you in the middle of the ocean, you know, a microbe has to sit in the ocean and survive getting eaten. So there's bigger things in the ocean that will come and eat them. And so there's a whole food chain that develops in the upper ocean. So things in the ocean need to think about competing and trying to really make sure they can have offspring, even though some of them are getting eaten, some of them are getting hit by viruses. And then when we think about the bottom of the ocean, right, the sediments, well, the joke is that basically there's not much going on in the sediments, because when we think about all of the carbon that's in the top of the ocean, of things that are able to use sunlight and make their own energy, about 0.1% of that carbon falls to the bottom of the ocean. And so people thought not much was going on there, but it turns out that a whole bunch of stuff is going on there. And we have some microbes that fall down in particles. And I always tell myself I have to talk about poop because I'm a microbiologist. And so imagine a fish poops, right? And that fish poop slowly sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And so that's one of the things that starts developing the sediments. And as things get into the sediments, they're all of a sudden in this physical environment. So they have places to hide. And they might not have to think about competing or growing really quickly anymore, but then they have to adapt to the conditions that are in the sediments. And what happens actually in the sediments is that you actually lose a lot of oxygen. So a lot of places, you'll actually go into an area where all the oxygen gets used up by higher organisms or things at the surface. And then the bottom of the sediments are a place where there's no oxygen and things will just kind of live slowly and grow for a long time. What's cool is they start making transformations of sulfur and methane and using other chemicals to actually support their lifestyles. And so there's a lot of really cool things that are happening deep in those sediments. And that's actually one thing that my lab really likes to work on. And so I probably annoy my students in marine sciences a lot because I call sharks big bags of carbon, right? We're actually pretty boring in terms of higher animals. We actually are all the same. You know, when I think of animals on the surface of the earth, like, to me, they're all kind of the same category, right? Because they're all eating sugar and they're outputting CO2. It's not that exciting to me. But what's really exciting is a hydrothermal vent. And at a hydrothermal vent, all of these things are happening and all different chemicals are there and different organisms are there and they're doing metabolisms and they're basically eating and pooping things that we've never even really considered before. And so it is actually sort of a science fiction thing, but it turns out since the late 70s, people have realized that this is a way that things can make their living. And I should mention that actually I have a tendency to speak about these things in very relatable terms. And so one of the first times I did this research, I talked about the cells that were living in the sediments. And one thing that was really surprising was that they weren't growing very quickly. So imagine you have a cell, right, an organism, but it's really not growing, and it's not doing much, but it's keeping enough alive. And I tried really hard to convey what it meant, and I used the word zombie, right? This idea that a zombie, right, isn't going to do the same lifestyle you or I would do. They're going to basically be these shells of a person, right? But they can still walk, they can still talk. I think they could eat, maybe. And so we can think about that in terms of a science fiction type example, in that we're dealing with things that actually have that kind of ability where they're they're hanging out, but they're maybe not alive the way we think of life typically. So I spend a lot of time thinking about very fiction-based things, is how do you know something's even alive?
So these like zombie-like microbes, I mean, it's just so interesting to think like they exist with us all day long. Like, are you someone who like thinks about this like outside of work? Because I mean, I would never think about the small organisms that make up everything around us.
So as a microbiologist, one of the great things is you can actually keep thinking about microbes all the time. Because if you go to the grocery store, right, half the things you are looking at or thinking about are microbes. If you see a spot on a piece of fruit, let's say, you can think, oh, is it damage? Is it microbial attack? Soy sauce, that's a microbial product. Tabasco is a microbial product, right? And then don't even get me started on yogurt. So yeah, I have taken this home and I think about this a lot. We make our own yogurt. I like to ferment my own sourdough, right? And think about the processes that microbes do in our everyday lives, because they really do a lot for us.
We're talking to Professor Jen Biddle from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. But I think it's fascinating that you do this work with all these little tiny animals. And have you actually been in some of the submersibles, like Alvin?
Yes. So this is actually something that I learned about when I was in college and I got very excited about. And then I guess I put it in the back of my mind and I went about life and I got a PhD in biochemistry. And then as I thought about what I wanted to do, I wound up going to work for what's called your postdoctoral. It's your time after your PhD where you're sort of learning more about science. And I worked with someone who did a lot of deep sea research and got into Alvin. So I've been on multiple Alvin dives and gone to the bottom of the ocean and seen tube worms and experienced the deep darkness and amazingly had that sort of experience of the vastness of the ocean by going to the bottom myself. And we've also used a lot of robotics. And so we'll put in systems where there's no person in it, but basically a robot that can go and collect samples for us and seen all sorts of things at the bottom of the ocean.
You're doing research on microbes while you're down at the bottom of the ocean. I mean, that's like going down to the macro scale, but you're down there getting your samples for the little tiny guys.
Yeah, and what's really neat is the ability to do a lot of different things at once. And so we would take samples and we'd be able to look at them for chemistry, we'd be able to look at them for the biology. We actually had temperature probes and we were able to look at temperature and how that was varying across the hydrothermal vents. And what's also really amazing is that we went to an area where actually the first thing I saw at the bottom of the ocean was a plastic bag. And so we saw a lot of trash and we saw other things at the bottom of the ocean that are part of our effect on the ocean. And you just can't forget about how much we are affecting the bottom of the ocean. But it's been really neat. And one of the coolest things I've seen is that we were in the Gulf of Mexico and we were actually using a robotic system. And when we went to the bottom of the ocean, we saw this thing sitting on the sediment that looked like a gold brick. And what was really neat is that that was methane, which most people think about methane as a gas. But we actually saw solid methane. So it's called hydrate. It's where methane basically creates ice. And that was really neat.
So you just touched on seeing plastics in the ocean. Is that something that you do research on, or is that kind of separate from microbes?
So that's a huge issue in the ocean right now. It's not something that I necessarily am researching myself. But what's been really interesting is that microbes like to grow in any kind of new environment you give them. And so with a ton of plastics and microplastics going to the ocean, and my colleague John Cohen at the School of Marine Science and Policy does a lot of work on this, we actually find that microbes are growing everywhere. And so I say that in a royal way, we're not doing it ourselves, but basically we're seeing that microbes can actually grow on that plastic. And what's hopeful is that microbes might be able to break down that plastic. But right now, I'd say that the jury's still out on that.
Are microbes type of organisms that are heavily affected by outside sources, so like that plastic, would it be detrimental? Would we care if it was detrimental?
So that's a good question in terms of most microbes are affected by outside sources. But what happens is usually a community shift. And so like, let's just say that you spill gasoline or oil in your yard, what's going to happen is that microbes usually will grow that actually can eat that. And they are really good at what's called bioremediation, about eating what's in the environment. It's not something my lab works on specifically, but it's something that we think about all the time in terms of general function. And so it would be a new potential habitat. It might not be detrimental for all microbes. It might be detrimental for some, but maybe some other ones like it. So we usually see that there's sort of a trade-off and that some things would like it and grow and some things won't.
Allie didn't know this, but I do, because one of the classes I teach is on intellectual property, and the first patent granted for genetic modification was to a microbe that was modified to eat the oil from an oil spill.
Yeah, and so they're actually hugely useful for engineering properties. And it's something that in my training, in my schooling, I've always kind of kept in the back of my head to think about how can we make a useful applied thing out of this system. It's taken me a while to actually start thinking about things that are a little bit more esoteric and that basic research idea of just understanding why things are the way they are just because. But we always think about potential uses down the line. And one of the cool things about what our lab or what my lab does is that we think about the exploration for microbes in terms of, again, can we find new antibiotics? Can we find new ways of thinking about systems that haven't been seen before?
So even though you work mostly with microbes that are in the ocean, you're looking globally.
Yeah, I always try to keep a sort of a very holistic sense in terms of seeing things. And it's what's fun is that sometimes you'll see an advancement that gets made in food science or an advancement gets made in agriculture. And it actually might inform what we're doing because the microbes are universal across all systems.
In preparation for this interview, we were emailing back and forth and you concluded your email, one of your emails with microbes are our friends, which you just touched on how we can use that for oil spills and all types of other things. But then you also said, except when they're not, they'll kill you. Can you, you know, expand on that?
When most people in the general public hear about microbes, they think about the ones that cause diseases, right? They're the most well-known. And I think that it's a reminder to keep in mind, right? That microbes, they're in you, they're on you, you know, they are our friends, they're beneficial, they keep us from harm, actually. They help us process food. They help give us fuel. They help make oxygen in the air we breathe. But then it's a sad reminder when you actually do come down with an illness and remember, like, oh, yeah, there are a couple of these guys that are not good.
That applies to the work you guys do in the ocean, too. I mean, right? I mean, there are some events that humans have done or that happen naturally that create microbes that cause a big bloom of something growing, and there are others that cause big dead spots.
Yeah, and so that's often a control of the nutrients in the upper environment. So again, not something my lab looks at.
Upper environment.
Well, in sort of the water environment and not the sediments. That's not something that my lab works on specifically, but it's something to remember in that the microbes, you know, they are bioreactors, basically. If you input a substrate, they'll turn it into a product, and that product could be themselves, and they bloom, and that could be bad for us, but they don't care. They were just eating and being happy. So,
how do you go about educating the public on microbes?
So that's a good question because it's really difficult. And I'm happy to talk to anyone about them. And what happens is typically we start talking about very common things like a yogurt or a sourdough or even an algal bloom. And those are much easier things for people to comprehend and understand. And I wound up not talking about my individual research so much because like some of the work we're doing is thinking about how microbes can grow deep, deep in sediments as they're actually hitting deep parts of the earth where basically there's tectonic plate movement and sort of much more hard to grasp concepts. And one of the things that we did is recently was we went up to the Delaware Museum of Natural History. And I was thinking, what should I do and how should I introduce this topic? And they have a traveling exhibit called The Zoo and You, I think it's still there, that was looking at microbes and basically human relationships. And I wound up actually deciding to just tell people that there were small things out there. And what we did was we took pond water. And we actually trapped the larger algal cells and concentrated them, and we looked at them on very simple microscopes. And students were amazed to see these little creatures swimming, you know, that in what looked like regular water. And that was just impressive for them to think that they're these big organisms. And I didn't have the heart to tell them that what we study is actually 1,000 times smaller. And so it is difficult to educate the general public. So I try to educate on general concepts, like what is DNA? Why do we look at DNA? Or that things are small. And actually, one of my favorite outreach activities I did, which was at our Coast Day on the Lewis campus. We have it every October. And I just tried to do a sense of scale. And I actually got to it because it was during the time of thinking about the 0.1% and the whole movement that was trying to think about income inequity. And I realized that the general public didn't even have scales of tens in terms of their knowledge. And so we went out and we took 1 milliliter of seawater and put it into small little tubes, right? And it doesn't look that impressive. It looks clear from the outside of the tube. And then I went and got sunflower seeds because it was the lowest cost thing that I figured most people would be okay with touching. And I put 1 sunflower seed in one bag and 10 in another bag and 100 and then 1,000 and 10,000 and 100,000. And eventually I filled a little baby swimming pool with 1 million sunflower seeds. And as people came up to the table, I said, how many microbes do you think fit in this little tiny bit of water? And I showed them that 1 milliliter. And they were really shocked because most of them pointed at the bag of 100 sunflower seeds or 1,000 sunflower seeds. said, no, it's a million. And they said, well, how much is that? And then I pointed to the baby swimming pool and I said, it's how much is in there? And they were just shocked to think that these things are that small, that you can fit a million of them into 1 milliliter of seawater, which is just a tiny bit of liquid.
Who counted out a million sunflower seeds?
My graduate students were really worried I was going to make them do that. And it turns out you can use weight as a proxy. So we used weight as a proxy. We counted out 100 and then we started multiplying up from there.
Very cool. Jen Biddle from the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment is with Allie and me today here on Campus Voices. And she specializes in microbes and particularly in those that live in the sediment of the ocean. But one of the things that's really cool about the university's College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment is it's a Sea Grant. We are a Sea Grant university, which means that part of your mission is the kind of outreach that you and Allie were just talking about. Tell us about the importance of that. Why is that such an important mission for the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment?
Well, I think right now that it's an important mission for us, especially because the ocean is in peril. And we know that climate change is happening and we're starting to see effects of it in the ocean. And if the ocean goes down, it's been our buffer for a long time. When the ocean starts to weaken even more and be affected by climate change, we're going to see much more drastic effects on land. And so a lot of us have been trying to speak out on issues related to that. For myself, it's also just educating people about the environment, right? People have a very person-centric view of their lives, and that's fine, except that we need to consider everything that's going on and that knowing, you know, even when I think about the fact that I am, you know, if I go to dig a garden and I put my shovel in the ground, you know, I'm impacting the ecosystem. And to think about the fact that all of these things are connected and they are interrelated. Through Sea Grant, we actually have a really fun outreach activity right now where we got funded to actually produce education and outreach videos based on the idea of the deep ocean environment. So it's called Project Video. I can't remember what video stands for right now. But it's been really fun because one of the things we've been doing with that is to try and get short snippets of information out there to sort of desensitize people to words like sulfate, right? The idea that when I mention sulfate as a potential energy source, people usually have their minds explode because they think, what? You know, they don't think about the fact that they're breathing oxygen and other things can breathe sulfate. But that's fine, and people do that, or animals are able to do that. And so we use these short videos as a format to just kind of introduce people to this terminology and get to be more familiar with them. We do it through pushing it out through Instagram and Facebook and Twitter feeds. And so the idea is that it falls into a social media profile that a user is hopefully seeing where it's not a scary thing. They see it on a regular basis. And one of the really fun things about it is we've been able to introduce all sorts of scientists through that program. And so I want people to know that when they think about a scientist in general, they shouldn't think about the, you know, the gray-haired, spectacled, you know, old man. That there's a lot of young people doing science out there and people of color and people that are coming from all sorts of backgrounds and that we're able to then put them into a visual feed for people and talk about science and just make this much more normal thing for people.
But it's also that science is not just an academic discipline. This relates to your daily life.
Yes.
If you wear sunblock into the ocean, that might affect the critters that are in the water.
Yes. And I think one of the reasons that people are very interested in microbes nowadays is that there's a lot of discussion in just regular media. You know, if you read the New York Times science section, there's a lot of discussion about microbes in guts and how does gut health impact depression? How does it impact diabetes? And we're realizing that these microbes are actually tied into the human system because, again, that presentation at the Museum of Natural History was talking about the idea that we are an ecosystem. We are not just one organism. We are actually a combination of multiple organisms, and that includes the microbes that are living in and on you.
This outreach that you go about doing, is that something that grad students and undergrads can also be a part of in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment?
Yes. So we're trying to get as many people to be a part of it as we can. And what we're able to do is have specific topics to go through and have people write a short script. So the most interaction we've gotten was with a program called 15 Second Science. And the idea is that you do a very short talk, maybe 12 seconds, and we're able to put it into a little stylized video that then introduces the topic that is being researched and gives a little bit of visual feedback and is, again, an easily digestible soundbite for science.
Where did you get the name for your Twitter feed?
So way back when I started that, I decided to be at subsurface_life because I thought at the time that I was going to use it for more of a professional basis. I actually still have a Jen Biddle Twitter feed that I keep meaning to change my tagline too, but I haven't switched that all yet. But I really thought that I would be focusing on it in terms of thinking about sediment-based processes and thinking about life under the surface, right? Under the surface of the ocean, under the surface of the sediment. And it's just sort of stuck at this point. So it's a bit of a remnant from me thinking I would stay totally professional. I will admit I'm not always totally professional on it. You'll hear about my chickens or my kid or, you know, crazy things that are going on.
But they're all hosts for microbes.
They are all hosts for microbes, yep.
Dr. Brittle, how did you become interested in becoming a marine scientist?
So I think that it was a byproduct of curiosity and frustration. And so I went into science really being interested in applied aspects of microbes. And as I went through my PhD, I was thinking about functional aspects of microbes. But it was around the same time that the methodologies for the research started changing. And I got exposed to the idea that there's all of these unknown microbes out there in the environment. And so we started thinking more about that, and I started getting more interested in the ecological aspects. And I wound up during my PhD wandering from the biochemistry department over to the geology department. And in the geology department, they were doing much more exploration-based things. And I wound up connecting with the geologists, wound up being interested in sediments, and actually got interested in them for the initial applied aspect. And one of the reasons is that the very deep ocean is cold, and I thought that if I worked on sediments, I would find new things for cold-based activity. Why do you care about cold-based activity? Well, it used to be that to get the best laundry, you know, the best laundry cleaning, you had to do it in hot wash because that's when all the chemicals and enzymes works the best. But if you know the product Tide Cold Water or some of these other efforts that have been made, there's an idea that you could save energy by using enzymes that are active in the cold and thinking about how things worked. And so that's how I got into it initially. I stayed in it because it turns out it's this great environment. And I joke that as I went through science, I went through biochemistry, which is, you know, I typify them as people that don't often go outside, right? And I was always the person who went back to graduate school on a Monday getting, you know, with a sunburn or something. And people said, well, where have you been? And I said, well, I went hiking or I did this or I went sailing. And I was kind of like the outcast, I guess. And so in the geology department, I fit in fine. And so I thought, oh, that's great. I'll hang out in geology. I wound up going into marine science, and what was great about marine science is you get to go explore the world. And so I got into marine science department, and because of my research, I was going to the bottom of the ocean, and I sailed across the Atlantic, and I did all of these things that I thought was just fascinating, and it was part of all of a sudden part of my regular job. And I, at that point, I was just kind of hooked. And so I've been able to be in a marine science department, still think about some applied aspects in terms of an industrial purpose, but then just go explore and basically have the world as my play box.
Do you scuba dive?
No, I don't.
But you do the submersible, the submarine routine.
Yes, you get in them when you're dry, and then they close the hatch, and you stay dry. So you don't have to get wet. It's kind of nice.
What do you actually see when you go underwater like that in the Alvin?
So when you first get in the Alvin and you get dropped off the ship, you start to sink slowly. And what's really neat is that you see the light coming from the surface. And as you get into that twilight zone, the bioluminescence becomes very important. So there's all of these organisms that are making their own light. And it was fantastic just to see these little sparks of these organisms swimming by. And then what happens is you get into the dark. And what's really fascinating is that it's dark. And I, the first time went, and I was very hopeful. I thought, I'll see something light up. I'll keep looking. And I think at that time, it took us about 2 hours to sink to the bottom. At this time, you actually save all the battery you can, and so all your lights are off. So you're in this dark sub, and your face is plastered out this little tiny window, and you're desperately looking for something. And after the first time of doing it, I realized I probably never will do it again because there's really nothing, right? You think about the ocean, you think about whales and dolphins and fish, and like there was nothing.
And you could just see nothing.
You could see nothing. Nothing came close to us.
But there was stuff out there.
Theoretically somewhere, but wasn't next to us. And then you get down to the bottom and the lights turn on. And then all of a sudden, there's this whole world of the bottom. And there's octopus and hydrothermal vents and all sorts of other things happening.
Microbes are everywhere. But Jen Biddle loves to play with the ones down there in the bottom of the ocean. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at WVUD.org.